Nearly 2 years into the presidency of Barack Obama, collective American anger at unemployment, bank bailouts, and the generally poor state of the economy has translated into focused populist organizing, but mostly on the right. The Tea Party movement, for a variety of reasons, has captured enough power from establishment partisan politics that it's managed to win nominations for congressional seats. But whither the left? Are most progressive organizations so eager to have a seat at the table of a president they helped elect that they're willing to be complicit in his compromises rather than hold him accountable? Longtime organizer and president of Consumer Watchdog, Jamie Court, has a simple message for progressives. It's time to start raising hell. His new book is called The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change We Voted For. Calling it a direct democracy toolkit, Court shares stories of many successful campaigns he's been involved in to illustrate winning strategies for progressives. The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell includes 10 rules of populist power, how to be an effective online activist, and a guide to using ballot measures to make gains. Filmmaker Robert Greenwald calls the book tough, smart, strategic. Read it and take action now. I spoke recently with Jamie Court. Here's part one of a two-part interview. How did the Supreme Court Citizens United ruling change the landscape of political campaigning? It's one of the first things you talk about in your book.
Well, it's in the way that Obama created a remarkable mandate in 2008 for affordable health care, reigning in Wall Street, ending the wars, the things he really didn't deliver on, but there was a mandate for. In many of the same ways, the Citizens United decision created a counterpower to all of that because it opened the doors to unlimited corporate funding of political campaigns. And what it did, I think, was make Obama and some others realize right on the heels of losing their filibuster-proof supermajority in the Senate that there is going to be unlimited corporate cash in the campaign system. We're not going to be able to close down the cash. So if you can't fight money with money, instead of raising money and pandering to donors, maybe we need to have an alternative like raising some hell rather than raising some money. And I think you saw right after Scott Brown lost the Senate race won the Senate race in Massachusetts, taking on the Ted Kennedy seat and denying the Democrats their filibuster-proof supermajority, you saw Obama come out of the gate and talk a lot more like Franklin Delano Roosevelt than he ever had, and said, "I've got to challenge this decision. We got to do something about it." He really came out of the gate trying to talk like a populist, and many of us don't believe he's really done more than talk. There is an opening here, I think, to say that if you want to make a name for yourself in politics, it's going to be about more about raising hell than raising money, because we'll never raise enough money to compete with the Exxons of the world, with the General Motors of the world, even as they go from government-owned to going to the stock market. We will never be able to compete on those terms. So there's an opening here for the kind of tactics we talk about in the book, leveraging public opinion, looking at when the public has 70% support for an idea, taking that idea and in politics, whether you're on the outside or the inside, running it on the basis of that strong public opinion, of strong public outrage at a problem, rather than worrying about who you're offending and how much money it's going to cost you in your campaign account if you're a political candidate. I think there's an opening. On the other side, you know, corporations are going to have a big stick to wag at elections, and politicians that buck them are going to face a lot of money. And the smart ones, I hope, will realize, you know, there's always money in politics, but if you can stand up for what you believe in, you'll be heard over the money, and you can beat big money. The book shows time and time again we've beaten insurance companies and health insurance companies, oil companies, by showing that they don't believe in the same social mores and ethical customs and rules of law that we as a society have agreed to and that 70% of the public believes in. So I think it's going to create a whole other dynamic. It's really going to rip through the political establishment, and people have to make a choice on the side of raising money or on the side of raising hell. And as it exists in Washington today, people are raising a lot of money and not raising very much hell.
So you say in your book that public opinion is crucially important, right? And as you just illustrated, but public opinion can be manipulated, particularly by corporations with lots of money. And even before the Citizens United case, there has been a lot of analysis by, you know, progressives over the years showing how consent can be manufactured through television, through advertising. advertising, through deceptive campaigning, through outright lies. And the more money you have to create very sophisticated campaigns, the easier it can be to fool the public. So are we going to be entering an era of super manipulation? You know, I mean, it's just sort of a frightening thought.
Well, you can't change public opinion. You could absolutely manipulate it. You can fool the public, but you have to fool them by talking their language. You have to fool them by tapping in to their beliefs and their moral sentiments. And what I see right now is a lot of anger at Wall Street, a lot of anger at health insurers, a lot of anger at corporations. That is the public sentiment of the day. There is no way with all of Exxon's money it's going to change anger at Exxon. There's no way with BP's money it's going to mute anger at BP enough that if someone had the right reform that BP could stop them. So we talk in the book about if you want to change things, which is very hard in society, you got to act on moments of opportunity where there's public anger. I have never seen this much anger at Wall Street or corporate America in modern American history. This has been created for us. And the question is, what can we do with it? And the point of the book is we can't wait for Obama to do anything with it. We got to do it ourselves. We've got to demand it. We've got to take on some of the tactics in the book as a way of tapping into public opinion. The sentiment is there. But the other thing that's really unusual and the book goes to is not just the step-by-step battle proven tactics that we've at Consumer Watchdog used to reform, you know, insurance companies or take down Arnold Schwarzenegger or go after the oil companies and win, things like that. We talk about how anybody at their computer through social media, on Facebook, on Twitter, on the internet, on a blog, can actually tap into that public opinion if they know how it's been done successfully before, and with an unbelievable video or with just the right idea, tap into that public opinion and get their idea on the table for serious change, either in a corporate boardroom or on Capitol Hill. Those two opportunities are actually exciting to me. As scary as the fact that we voted for a president who didn't deliver for progressives on what he said he was going to deliver on and betrayed many key promises, the fact that we now have some very big sticks to hold over his head and hold over Democrats' heads, the stick of public opinion as an anti-corporate sentiment and the stick of the social media revolution, that's exciting to me. What I'm worried about, this is more scary to me, is that progressives are not talking about their anger in any great number the way the Tea Party is. They're mad as hell. They think the Tea Party's insane, as I do, but they're not getting out there and finding ways to demand change creatively with these two big sticks. Instead, they're worried about the balance of power if they criticize Obama, if they criticize Democrats. And what the book tries to do, what Raising Hell tries to do is say, hey, the only way to save progressives, the only way to save the Democratic Party is if we go out there and make some demands and make our leaders respond and make them meet us halfway. And there are some huge opportunities, you know, at the state level in California. A ballot measure could create a public option to the private health insurance market. That's something we're working on in 2012. I think in Washington, D.C., with the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, we can actually make the Obama administration do some real tough things on credit card companies that will tap into public sentiment and change things. But we can't not be angry. We can't walk away. I think that's what's scaring me, is that progressives and people who are like who voted for Obama are walking away and taking themselves out of the process altogether rather than showing their anger and using it to create change, because anger is what creates change.
Well, I want to talk about the using of the ballot box. It's part of your title as well, and certainly living in California here, it's an interesting tool both for the public as well as, of course, for those in power. But let's go to your 10 rules of populist power. Your first rule is forcing opponents to make mistakes as the goal of effective advocacy for change. Promoting issues is not enough. What do you mean by forcing opponents to make mistakes?
Well, every real change campaign I've ever been involved in, and the first campaign that got me involved was the insurance reform initiative, Prop 103, that the Consumer Watchdog's founder, Harvey Rosenfield, wrote and passed this tremendous regulation of the insurance industry, over $60 million in insurance company money. The insurance companies in that campaign, for instance, their big mistake was spending $60 million when Harvey had no money to spend. So everyone knew that Prop 103 was the initiative that was going to reform the insurance companies because the insurance companies were spending $60 million against it. They made a huge mistake. Harvey it was a classic changemaker campaign. It's about exposing the insurers on popular anger over auto insurance rates. It was about confronting the insurance companies with a ballot measure. And then it was about waiting for their mistake. They spent so much money, they revealed their hand. The public passed Prop 103 with 51% of the vote. In every campaign I've ever been involved in, that's how it goes. You expose an issue. You create a high profile on an issue where there's a strong public sentiment in your favor. You confront the troublemakers, the people who've created this problem. And then you wait for them to do something really stupid. In Obama's case, for instance, on Obamacare, what did the health insurers do? When it looked like this was on death's door, when Obama had given away the public option to the private market, reversed himself, and made everyone have to buy health insurance by 2014, and there's no public option, he'd been an undertaker for the public option. It was and the bill still couldn't get out. What did Anthem Blue Cross did? They raised rates. 39% in California, and it gave the president something to run around the nation, mobilize anger around, take that mistake, and literally force Obamacare through Congress. Now, nothing in the final federal reform actually regulates health insurance rates, but that did not matter. Everybody knew the insurers were the opponents. So now we've got to go back and actually do that at the ballot box or elsewhere, regulate health insurance premiums based on the fact that insurers are again making another mistake. They're raising rates, saying it's Obamacare's fault, so we'll give them an answer. We'll regulate their premiums on health insurance the way we regulate auto insurance rates under 103. By the way, under Prop 103, the Consumer Federation of America found that the initiative has saved $62 billion for auto insurance policyholders in the state through 2008. It's a tremendous model. Insurers, auto insurers, homeowners insurers have to ask permission to raise rates, and you can, they don't get it, and groups like mine can intervene. This is a public process, and the elected insurance commissioner created as an elected position by Prop 103 says yes or no.
But in health insurance, you can't.
That you can't do it in health insurance because it was a single subject rule, so we didn't regulate health insurance in 1988. But we can do it now. And so the conditions that created Prop 103 were there was a mandatory auto insurance law, and there was no regulation of the premiums. Now we have a mandatory health insurance law in 2014, a ticking time bomb. The middle class is going to be really angry about this. And yet there's no regulation of health insurance premiums. It is a perfect setup, not for just us at the ballot, but as we wrote the president just last week, for President Obama. He should be demanding premium regulation in the Senate. And if Senator Feinstein's bill on that matter can't get through, he should say, I'm going to go to the states. I'm going to go to the 24 states with a ballot measure process. I'm going to pass premium regulation. I'm going to give every American a public option who I can at the state ballot box because we can have a public option in California. So he's not thinking as an outsider, but a few more losses like the midterm election might get him to start thinking like that. I mean, there is a strategy by which we can finish the job of that 2008 election if we all expose the problem and confront the troublemaker. In this case, the troublemaker is not just the industry. It's the leadership in Washington, D.C. of the Democratic Party.
I'm speaking with Jamie Court. He is the president of Consumer Watchdog, and his latest book, The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change We Voted For. So it seems as though oftentimes progressives get very caught up in wanting an overhaul of something, right? We want we want single-payer health care, and so we end up not getting either that or even a public option because we want to be pure. We want to be true to our ideals. And is that something that you think often sort of shoots ourselves in the foot, ends up with progressives shooting themselves in the foot?
Well, I think it's fine to want single-payer health care. I want single-payer health care. But what is the strategy and the tactics that are going to get us there? And that's kind of the book addresses. I mean, the strategy and tactics I lay out in the book on the coming progressive rebellion is you want single-payer health care? Great. Now we've got the government owning the health insurance system. The government said you got to buy health insurance. This is a very offensive thing when the average health insurance policy for a family of four is $12,000 a year. I mean, this is what's fueling the Tea Party. Well, it could fuel a larger coffee party, which is, a progressive answer to the Tea Party. It could fuel a progressive rebellion if we say that's unacceptable, absent a choice not to have to have health insurance through private insurers. So the public option at the state level, what it does is create conditions where people can choose the single payer. A public option is basically a public health insurance system that doesn't deal with insurers. Now, we have a system here, the California Public Employee Retirement System. It has what is like a public option in it because one the PPO option is an option that doesn't use insurance companies' money. It's administered by Blue Cross for a set fee of 3%, but there's no profits for insurers built in. There's there's about between four and 500,000 people in at any given time. We all could have access to that. And I'm telling you, if you open up a system where there's no insurance company profits or overhead in it, the public, 70% of the public, will go for it. And the minute 40% of the public goes for the public system over the private system's not going to be around. So it's, again, you're thinking about things strategically. I mean, they call public option a Trojan horse to the for single payer. And whether it's a Trojan horse or not, I mean, strategically it is. It is absolutely a way to get there. And there's nothing the matter with that. There's nothing the matter because if private insurers can't do as good a job as the government, they shouldn't be in business. And that's the challenge that you lay out with a public option. So strategically, the problem is we sold ourselves on this. As progressives, I mean, I was a little. We opened an office in D.C. In 2008, trying to push as hard as we could for the things we wanted, and then Obama just gave it up, and the main public interest groups in D.C. basically said, "Well, we can't criticize the president. We better get something." Now, there are things in health reform that are very good. The most progressive parts of health reform are things we've been working on for 10 years. You can't be canceled because you had an innocent omission on your enrollment form by a health insurer. They can't charge you based on your medical condition. They have to sell you a policy. I mean, you have to buy it, but they have to sell it to you. So it's kind of a wash. But people will have health insurance. But what they didn't deal with is the price. And what they didn't deal with is the public option. And so I actually strategically think it's good that we have a federal health reform law because now the government, the Congress, the president own this system. They got to fix it right. Or they got to get rid of it.
Now that they're involved, we can hold them accountable. But before, it was completely separate and in the hands of the private insurances.
There's no rules, and before the government had no obligation to come in because there was no political consequence if they didn't. And you know, that's one of the things we talk about in the book is political accountability. How do you hold anybody in a public office accountable? I mean, you know, the tactics, the rules of populist power, but also the steps of expose, confront, change, expose, confront, wait for a mistake. Public officials usually bury themselves when they're put on the hot seat by someone who wants to create change.
So it's a matter of taking advantage of those moments.
And forcing those moments. You know, we helped run Bill Frist out of office, the Senate minority leader years ago, minority and majority leader years ago, because he owned stock in HCA, the hospital company that his family built, and it also owned a medical malpractice insurance company. He basically got disgraced years ago because he sold the stock, basically what looked like an insider tip. But 3 years before that, we had written a record, Consumer Watchdog, and put on the map the fact that he held the stock in his family's corporation. He was sponsoring legislation to limit liability of hospitals, and he had a stake in the largest hospital corporations in America that his family had started, and that there was a lot of press and we filed an ethics letter, and it helped stop this very bad legislation. But what it ultimately did was 3 years later come back to hurt him when he sold the stock. He made a very big mistake by not being proper about all this. So your insurance commissioner Chuck Quackenbush, who we ran out of California along with the LA Times, because he took $6 million from the insurance companies and he regulated the insurance companies. Well, he made a very big mistake of trying to shake down the insurance companies for a public foundation. And once people found out about that, it became a very big problem for him and the balance of power shifted. So it's always our opponents' mistakes. In this last election, we're fighting Mercury Insurance against Prop 17. Prop 17 was in the most conservative election in June you can imagine because there was no gubernatorial contest in the Democratic Party. We had an insurance company spend $16 million to say, I'm going to give you discounts on your auto insurance. And they went all the state, and we raised a lot less money. We outspent 12 to 1, but we beat them. We beat them because we said, when was the last time an insurance company spent $16 million to lower your auto insurance rates? A key part of this campaign was that Mercury had made some very big mistakes that the Department of Insurance raked them over the coal for, not paying discounts in the past, not giving people what they were promised. And because of those mistakes and the public record, we were able to show this is a bad insurance company and you cannot trust them. In the final tally, in the most conservative election you can imagine, of 5 million votes, we defeated Prop 17 by 200,000 votes. It was a very, very close call, and it was all based on the fact that there was a lot of anger and a lot of public opinion against the insurance company. We had a lot of editorials in every major newspaper in the state. The LA Times did three. We had a lot of news articles all about this power grab. And the defeat of Prop 16 was very similar when PG&E tried to pull one over on the voters as well. And the voters heard Pacific Gas and Electric, and they stopped it. So I think you can do an amazing things in politics with very little money if you have the right message at the right time, and your opponents give you a very big mistake.
Which they usually inevitably do, I suppose, if you wait long enough. My guest is Jamie Court. We're talking about his book, The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change We Voted For. So let's talk about some of these other rules of populist power that you talk about in your book. There's 10 rules altogether. Go through them, if you will, for our listeners. Are these based on other political strategists' work, or are these purely from your own political experience and work that you've done over the years?
Well, they're purely from my own political experience, but everything we do is based on someone else's work.
Sure.
I mean, you know, I wrote the book because the first book I read 20 years ago when I got involved in organizing was Rules for Radicals.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of a good book about tactics and strategies since. I mean, when the book was released last week, and Robert Greenwald did a nice video about the book, which gave it a little bit of a bump. The filmmaker Robert Greenwald did a 3-minute video, and we put it out, and he put it out, and it talked about how you can use your anger for change. We got down on the Amazon rankings and to 500, which was pretty good at the time, and we were number one in civics. Number two in civics was Rules for Radicals, because there hasn't been a great civics book. Number three was the Manifesto of the Tea Party. So this is an empty field, unfortunately, because people don't really practice this type of populist politics. But, I mean, I talk about, things that, that have come together in my mind, but obviously based on other people's work. And I'll give you a good example. Rule two is to make big changes, target the little things and the few people. And it is always about that. We only have so much energy. If you're going to change anything, you gotta find that little place where things change, or the right decision maker, and lean on them.
Then you can change the balance of power by even getting one person to either change their position or even be kicked out of their position altogether.
Exactly. Or this is a good example of how I did take some theory from other people, and I talk about in the book how Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book, very important book called Tipping Point, that talks about how all change occurs. And in it, he makes very much, through statistical research, he shows the same point, that it's always very small things that make a big change. I'll give you a good example of one thing that we talked about was George Joseph, who is the head of this Mercury Insurance, who we just beat in Prop 17. Well, this guy's been coming after insurance reform for a long time, and one of the examples was, years ago, we had finally got rules that said the zip code should no longer be the factor in auto insurance. It was the last unfinished business of Prop 103. And going back to some old allies, my friend Robert Greenwald was pretty upset that George Joseph was going to do a ballot measure to undo that rule, spend money. It would have been the precursor of Prop 17. And we wanted to get George Joseph, the head of Mercury Insurance, to stop him from doing it. So Greenwald sent a crew out to his house, followed him around with a camera, started to confront him like, why are you African Americans in the inner city are paying more for auto insurance when they're charged by their zip code? Why don't you like African Americans? Why don't you like people of color who pay higher rates? And he got very upset about it. And he also got upset about the counter initiative that we filed to stop him. And just by going after that one guy who was the problem here, he backed off within about a week and pulled back his ballot measure, and the rules to have zip code based auto insurance in California went into effect. And now you are not charged primarily based on your address, and we're the only nation we're the only state in the nation that does that.
I'm speaking with Jamie Court, president of Consumer Watchdog and author of The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change We Voted For. This is part one of a two-part interview. Tomorrow we'll play part two.